Welcome to The Running Public with Bracken Crocker and Kirk DeWint.
Whether you are a brand new runner or you already have a great mustache,
we're here to help you increase your running knowledge and present it at a practical level. This is The Running Public. When you're ready to take your training or racing to the next level, go to therunningpublic.com. We have both monthly subscription training plans, $19.99 a month, and Bracken and I both offer one-on-one customized coaching. Again, go to therunningpublic.com and check out our offerings.
Do you hear him?
Oh, I hear him. That was poor timing.
It is. Yesterday, 2 days ago, some came by during beginning of race brain and no one heard him. I don't know why it's picking up today.
Yeah. Good start, Bracken. How we doing?
Oh, I'm on edge, Kirk. A little on edge.
Really?
I have a package due for arrival between 11:30 and 1:15 today, it says.
Okay.
1:45. It didn't arrive yet, and now we've started.
Is anybody home to receive this package?
Mira is home sick from school, and she can't be trusted to do anything.
So what do we do?
It sits on my porch until I'm done, but I could have the contents of that package on my feet right now as we record, and I don't.
What is it?
Hoka Tecton X3.
Mm. Yeah, I've heard really good things, and too bad it's such an ugly shoe.
It is. It is. And since regaining the ability to run trails again, my ankle is still, the one I took 7.5 weeks off with, is still not 100%, but it's probably 90. This is a really long, we're at like 15 weeks or something like that. Like this is I would have rather broke it at this point, but I can run trails now. And so I've been testing out all these trail shoes that I had to test out and to try and to find out like if any of them are good for me. And I wasn't able to do it for so long. So I've been going back through and trying these things. And I have been so disappointed by the trail, quote unquote, super shoe offerings. And I've been working my way up. I've been starting with the ones that are more readily available and saving some of the high-end ones for if they get sent to me or if I find them on sale.
Mm-hmm.
But I finally just decided these that I have are not what they're supposed to be. And I just need to get the one that everyone keeps saying is awesome. So I have the X's, the X3s coming in today.
What's the price point on those?
I think they're like $265 or something. I'm going to look it up real quick. I luckily didn't have to pay a full price.
And you will have the least amount of debris in your shoe. $275.
That's obnoxious.
Debris-free shoe. That's
debris-free.
That's worth that money. Almost like a built-in ugly sock attached
ugly sock.
To it. You're so blessed.
I got the new color, that apple green, whatever they call it, sour apple.
Hmm.
I don't think it's going to be any better.
So if you want these streak flies I bought, you can have them. That shoe is for, I don't know who, but it ain't for me.
It's an acquired taste.
That shoe is the most spongy, lack of energy return, light shoe I've ever worn. I thought at least I'd have some firmness, and it's like my feet just sink into the ground, and it sucks up all my energy and then gives me none back.
None.
That shoe, I'm going to literally use it as a grass cutting shoe. That shoe's dead to me. I ran in it once. That thing is done. Anyways, if you want it, it's a perfectly fine 10.5 streak fly. And that shoe is one of the worst shoes ever made. There, I said it.
This right here is why there's no such thing as listen to someone's recommendation blindly. Because it's a perfectly good shoe for my rotation.
I would wear that for a recovery run that I, for some reason, needed to feel good about having something light on my foot. That is not a performance shoe. That's what I think I was disappointed in.
Yeah. Like I said, that was a mislabeled shoe.
It's not
a 5K, 10K racer in that is not any era.
No. So that was my expectation.
Yeah.
And that shoe is like the lightest, spongiest pillows underneath your feet that don't give you any boing. Really bizarre.
That right there is everyone's answer to why our carbon plate's important, because that is Zoom X foam.
It's not. And then I had the Vaporfly, and I literally brought him as a backup. I ran in the, God, now I'm forgetting the name all of a sudden. I just, the dang shoe I hate. That's how dead to me they are.
Say its name.
I can't, I don't even want to. The Streakfly. I put them on. I ran one rep in them, and I took them off, and I ran to the locker room and got my Vapors to finish out the workout. And I was like, oh my God, thank you. Like this, they're not even in the same stratosphere.
The plate, even a plastic plate, any sort, even the rods, allow the foam to do its thing. Without it, it is aimless.
Felt like light silly putty under my foot. All right. Enough about shoes. We talked about shoes on our episode earlier this week. You know what? If you're nice to me one day, I'll give them to you.
I should make, we've done this before on here. I have a brand new size 11 pair of Nike Alpha Fly 2. I don't even know if you can find those anywhere anymore. Maybe you can. Nike Alpha Fly 2 size 11 never worn. I got the wrong size. It's in the box. If you just need the twos in your life, talk to me. I will give you a fantastic deal on that shoe. Send me a message if you want the Alpha Fly 2. I would already have sent them to Kirk, but he's a 10.5. And I don't even know if you like the two.
I've never worn it.
Yeah.
All right. Let's not turn this into Facebook Marketplace, though. Huh? All right. Today's episode. Is there anything else you want to banter about that seems important?
No.
All right. Well, you really said my mustache looked gross before we started recording, but I'm going to...
Everyone who's watching already knows.
Luckily, my self-esteem is pretty high to start with, so I can take a hit like that.
Mustache is not gross.
Mustaches are gross.
Mustaches are gross.
I think there's some gentlemen and ladies out there that would beg to differ.
Oh, I know there's a market for it. I'm not the intended audience. And as someone who didn't shave for like 10 days, didn't buzz or anything when I was sick, I was astounded by the amount of things that get caught in your mustache hair.
Condiments. Yeah.
Soup. For sure. If you blow your nose with something that has little fibers in it, suddenly you have a powder coating on your mustache. It is not hygienic. And if you treat it in such a way that it becomes hygienic, then you are spending far too much time grooming your upper lip hair and time should be spent elsewhere.
Listen, I couldn't agree more. Glad we got that out of the way.
I support your mustache. I don't support mustaches.
Well, my wife says I look super cute, Bracken.
And what did I tell you initially?
Good for her.
That's all that matters.
That's all that matters. All right. So today we have a Q&A for you. Looking back, our longest sitting in queue message is from November 15th. So we go back that far. We had gotten caught up to November 15th. I don't remember when we did our last Q&A, but the oldest message in here is November 5th. So somebody has waited like 9 weeks for this. Sorry about that.
Our Q&A is like reverse dog years. 9 weeks of waiting for our Q&A messages are like 2 weeks. In real life business correspondence.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I could do a Q&A every week because I enjoy them. At the same time, I don't want to burn them out either. But that just means sometimes people wait a little long. So shall we?
We shall. Fire them at me.
And we're not going to do anything cute with this one. We're going to give each question the time we feel necessary and we'll move on. I doubt we'll get to everything. And so people wait. We got 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 8, about 18 screenshots.
Not a chance.
Probably not. All right. Brandon asks, question for a Q&A. How would you suggest training for a fast 1 mile to 5K? No intention of ever going over 5K in a race and already doing plenty of strength training. So we're looking at the 1 mile to 5K with no intent to do more. Well, lucky you, I did a bit of that in college, Brandon. But why don't you start this?
You did it in college. Take your real life experience and I'll give my other side of the coin.
It depends what phase of training we're in. So it depends, Brandon, first of all. But let's say we are at competition phase. So we say that we're in the middle of the season.
Yep.
To start, I would say a 15 is your cap. At this point, let's say races are, what do we want to say? Within 4 weeks or something. So we're really trying to be ready for it all. Is that fine? What do you think? The main thing here I'm going to say is, granted, you had a great build, whatever that means. Let's just not touch that part of it. The overspeed component is probably a staple every week. And by overspeed, I mean overspeed for the 5K, and we're touching mile speed as well. A lot of mixed modality sessions where maybe we do pyramid style or buy-ins. If you're really racing both, we need to do a little bit of both. If I'm also racing both, I'm not running that far on my long runs. What would you cap it at? I'd cap mine at like 12-ish mid-season, and maybe that's only every other weekend, with every other weekend replaced with some sort of threshold type workout. But I'm probably going to reduce mileage. 12-ish would be more than enough as far as long run duration. And I'd be doing quality twice a week, touching or faster than race pace once. And I'd still keep some sort of threshold session in there once per week. Because if you let that go, your fitness will erode faster than you'd like to believe. So that's a very vague answer to start without a lot of specifics. But that's where my head went first.
Okay. I like it. I'm only going to argue one point there. I don't even feel the need for a long run in season.
Okay. Well, I said every other week, but yeah.
Yeah. I honestly would, for a track runner, I wouldn't even bother every other week, because you're not a 10K runner and that time could be better spent doing more speed work. So I would
probably, it has an expiration date though. That's the thing. At some point.
It does. I think to keep, you know, to throw a spongy term at it, to keep your aerobic capacity topped off, I think 8 or 9 is fine. I don't think I'd go beyond 9, but again, that's arguing, nitpicking things. The real answer for me is, I think you need the stamina, the stay power, the endurance of your 5K, and you need your speed of your mile. And I think I would spend 2/3 of the time working the 5K end and 1/3 of the time working the mile. And I would keep it as simple as that. How that looks will change slightly, but you are going to run a good either one of them off that kind of training. But when in doubt, you lean longer. So that's why 2 out of 3 pieces of my pie are going to be on the 5K side.
I very much agree with that. We've preached pay the longer distance the most lip and time service. And I would actually say, the mile and the 5K are so different. Like, vastly. Like, you may think, like, the mile and the 5K are in the same, we're circling the same waters of fitness. Nope. 5K, 10K, even though they're further apart, right? 3 miles apart versus 2 miles apart for the mile of 5K. 5K and 10K are so much more similar than a 5K and mile. And that's where I'm like, depending on what your background is or your tendency as an athlete, like, I would have to pay that mile a lot more service at this point versus the 5K. But they're very different. Like, they look on paper like 1 and 3 miles, pretty close, not at all. Yeah. That's how I feel about them.
Yeah. And I think for non-national and above level runners, you can run pretty darn close to your best mile off of 5K training. Assuming the mechanical skill efficiency of running the pace you intend to run. I think the engine of a 5K will get you in the mid-90s% of the way to your best mile if you're not trying to be national or above level. That's enough for you. But you need to be able to run faster than mile pace in your sleep.
Yep.
And that only comes from working that skill pretty frequently. So I don't even think you need high dosages of mile or faster pace. You just need them frequently enough that the stride is not weird or new or uncomfortable for you. And the engine of the 5K is going to take you all the way through.
Yeah. It'd be a great place for like broken 5K work, starter 2s and 4s, bulk of your 5K training in the middle, finisher at the end, at or faster than mile pace. If you're trying to do it all, yeah. I would say like the mile compared to the 5K is like the 200 compared to the 800. Like, they're almost that different. Almost.
Okay.
That's a stretch, I know. You're like, I don't know how I feel about that. But,
well, we know that the mile is the tipping point between an event being primarily aerobic and primarily anaerobic. The 800 meter is primarily anaerobic. The 5K is more aerobic than anaerobic. The mile is that tipping point. And the 5K is also 3 times longer than the mile. Though it is very dissimilar. And yet, being good at the above one will make you better at the below than making being good at the below distance will make you good at the above distance.
I know
that's a mouthful.
No, as much as the 200 would make you good at the 800.
But a good 800 runner could probably rip an okay too.
Correct. Yeah. Do you see a delay on your end? Am I all choppy and delayed to you?
A little bit.
Yeah, I don't know where that's coming from. I'm like a little robotic over here. Maybe that'll correct itself. I should like make sure my internet is good here. Bear with me. Sometimes I connect to the neighbor's internet, Lori's internet, and it does its own, and then it's just a real gong show, but we're good.
Well, I think that we have seen enough examples in our track running career to show that 5K runners can almost always compete pretty well with milers at the mile. And it takes a certain type of miler to compete well with a 5K runner. People drop down way better than they move up. All throughout college, there's always guys who drop down and run a great 1500 from being 5K, 10K guys, but very few of the reverse. And so as long as you can have that efficiency of running that pace, you need way less time spent working those mile grueling workouts than I think most people assume you do.
Yeah. And you look across the board in the NCAA, like Wisconsin's Adam Spencer or the Washington crew that has like five guys that go sub four in the mile. And then you look at how they, and Adam Spencer was what, second at NCAAs in the mile or 1500. And then you look at what they do in cross country and almost all of them aren't even all Americans. At best, they're finishing in the 20s or 30s, yet they may be the best miler in the country. It's really hard to make it go that way, but the other, it can work better. That's just an example that came to my head. All right. You ready for the next one?
Yep.
All right, Dusty says, I was thinking about sending this in as a podcast topic, but haven't gotten around to it yet. But I just listened to the newest episode, and you guys answered a question that is related to what I wanted to mention. So, possible podcast topic. By the way, if that happens, I usually put these sort of things in the Q&A because we can usually hit these topics in the Q&A. how to be a good athlete, or in other words, how to be coached well. I really liked this question. What do you guys like to see from an athlete, from the athletes you coach in regards to feedback, daily conversations, input about programming, etc.? What are some things you don't like to see? I know a lot of things are discussed between the coach and athletes up front, but it would be interesting to hear what an ideal athlete slash coach relationship looks like from your perspective. I think that would help those of us who are being coached to get an even better understanding of what you guys look for as coaches.
If I look back at the relationships that I've had with athletes that got to the point where we could read each other's minds, they all, and I think that's the ideal place to be for most people. There are some people who want to be blindly led all the way up to the pro level. There are pros who just need to be treated like a racehorse.
Yep.
But the ideal relationship is that you know the what and the why of everything. And I think that starts with people who ask questions early and listen and then ask for confirmation. So why are we doing this workout? And then they're told why. And later on, they're like, so is this workout done for this kind of purpose as well? That the questions that bring them closer to your line of thinking are the things that are going to allow them to get the most out of workouts in the future. So I think that's my most common thread of the athletes that I've had great long-term relationships with is that it started with questions early on, not afraid to ask why, and then like take a guess and make themselves be put out on a limb in case, oh no, I guessed wrong on that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do know what you're saying. And early in a coaching career, it's easy to take those questions a little defensively to be like, why are you questioning my programming? What do you mean? Right. Why? What are you asking why for? Like, do what you're told, right? That's not how I think, but I'm saying when you're early in your career and you maybe aren't as confident in your programming or you don't even know why, because there's a lot of coaches that don't know why where they're prescribing what they're prescribing. And then you get to a point where you sort of appreciate the questions. There's a point of overkill as well, where the questions can become unnecessarily frequent and often, but the fine line of the why am I doing what I'm doing, I agree. I appreciate somebody who wants to learn.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, that's exactly it. Someone who wants to learn.
Mm-hmm. I will say we've had a version of this conversation on the podcast before, and I don't remember when or what, but the biggest thing is just being kept in the loop as to how things are going. Like somebody who truly checks in with you, lets you know how they're feeling physically and emotionally sometimes about how things are going. Like, it is very difficult to help somebody truly if you don't know what's going on, you know? And so I just think an athlete who keeps their coach, me, in the loop, and it doesn't need to be a novel or a huge 30-minute conversation every week, but something that says, hey, I know where you're at on this, the 1 to 10 scale of health, energy, and emotionally how I'm feeling about things. Give me a barometer and we're probably going to be somewhat similar, or at least find our track correctly. And so just like knowing where you're at, that is just like the biggest thing. Yeah. For me, like that leads the way completely. Like I got a half a dozen athletes. I don't know what the heck's going on with them. I hear from every few weeks. I reach out, they don't respond. I don't have a freaking clue. You're wasting your money with me, that athlete who doesn't ask questions or respond or reach out. You make my job super easy, but like you are not getting the most or the best out of this.
Right.
And that bothers me more than the over-communicator.
As you're talking about this, I'm picturing two professors I had in college.
Okay.
And one of them was probably like 70-ish. And he would sit there and someone would ask a question, and sometimes like in a snotty way, or so, you know how young college kids get out to college, read something, and suddenly they're the smartest person they've ever met, and they'll like lecture their professor.
I mean, sure.
Like sometimes that happens. Anyways, so even if it wasn't a great question, sometimes it was a situation where he's sitting there knowing this person's wrong and they're kind of a jerk about it, but he just delighted in the process of people learning things. And you could just see that he enjoyed the conversation of leading them to self-discovery that they were wrong. Didn't delight in them being wrong, but delighted in the concept of, let's talk through this. And then I had a professor who was so arrogant, who could get so mad at students if they didn't get things or if they questioned him. And both professors were getting the same question types, but one of them was just universally despised by students. And one of them, like, probably never, if he wanted to, would have to pay for a meal the rest of his life or a drink, because everyone just like wanted that guy to be their uncle or their grandpa, because he would just sit there and talk you through anything. Even though he was pretty sure he knew more than you, he would just allow the conversation to get you there. And I think that's what like we're kind of describing, is a good athlete coach relationship is that. I'd like to hear what you think about that, and then I'd like to talk through it, and you're either going to find out you're wrong, or I'm going to learn something today, and it's going to change how I move forward, but we're going to delight in the process of the back and forth. Mm-hmm. And that can be done in a few couple texts, right? And it can be done in a video call, or it can be done over the course of a few months of exploring things in training, but it can't be, I won't do your workout, and it can't be, you must do my workout. It's the one that's genuinely curious to know why, so that they can better themselves. And then in return, the person who's generally excited to explain why.
Hmm. Yeah. And we run two different, I don't know if you run this, maybe you run this style now, because Bracken and I run our one-on-one coaching separately, and then we come together on the running public. But I find the athletes who choose to have regular video calls with me, we get to those places so much quicker than athletes who choose to save a couple bucks and not do the monthly or biweekly calls, whatever you run. So I just find like communicating in that way, being able to look people in the eyes or have real conversations more frequently, tends to facilitate their progress a little quicker and get on the same page, have an understanding, create a long-term relationship. Mm-hmm. And I've had people with me for 6-8 years now that we've never had a video call other than on occasion, putting out a random fire or touching base once a year. But I would say the more frequent communication where you're actually looking and talking to each other makes a difference. You've mentioned how much more invested you get when you're interacting on that level, for example. And so I think that's helpful for a coach as well. But we need to provide affordable options for people that don't include that. So it all is part of it. But I think that the longer I do this, the more I realize that's helpful as well.
I'll tell you my biggest pet peeve with an athlete.
Okay.
And it may be, I don't know if it might be tied for biggest. The other one I won't get into because it's just like a personal, like, that's my hang up, whatever. But this is when
I think I know what you're going to say.
Really?
I do.
Okay. When an athlete brings their previous relationships or flaws into ours, much like in a dating relationship, when they move forward with our workouts or our training, in a way that was influenced by a previous coach or their own assumptions about running in a negative way. Like, I want an athlete to trust themselves. I want an athlete to push back against me. I want an athlete to understand, like, this isn't happening. I need to pull the plug. But I can't stand when people are like, oh, I saw this workout and I didn't do it because that doesn't work for me. Or someone else I used to work with used to give me this type of workout and that's just, it's a non-starter. I changed it. Or this rep was 5K, 3x5K in long intervals. I just can't do, I get hurt with those. Or long intervals are too boring. I don't do those. So I changed the workout to, you know, 15x1000 rather 3x5K. That drives me nuts more than almost anything else. When people just make rash decisions based on pre-existing bad experiences or ignorance.
Assumptions, right?
Yeah. I don't care if you can't do that workout. That's fine. But we have to talk through that then. Mm. Not just this doesn't work for me. I want to know why it doesn't work for you. I want to understand, are you correct in that? And I need to adjust my programming? Or were you implementing the workout wrong in the past by yourself or with another coach? And if we did it with a different zone that we're working in, this would be a great workout for you. But there's a few people who are constantly changing the workout and never learning from it.
And almost all those people, it's because they're running too hard or too fast for something of long duration. Generally, it's somebody who has not a great handle on energy management or pace management. And so they hate those longer grindy workouts and they end up cutting them down or whittling them down or making them more bite-sized. That would be the most common case in which I see that.
Yeah. And there's a difference between I had 16 to 20 by 400 and I capped it at 16 because I could feel that these last four were going to cost too much. And I don't do 400s. So I changed it to 3x1 mile instead of 16 by 4 or 4x1 mile. And then just that's it. Not asking for, so what should we do next time or whatever? Just, hey, want you to know I didn't do that because this. That's it. Moving on. Like that's not a learning process.
Just because we're speaking of those. Coaching is like, honestly, I feel very, and I know we've had this conversation off mic, how lucky, like this is a very fulfilling career. And we are both like, I wouldn't trade doing what I do for anything. So we're just, you ask the question. So we are answering the question. And I want to ask how often, you know, once in a while you'll get somebody who you're like, this just isn't even worth it to me. Like the stress of the relationship somehow for many reasons can end to a point where you're like, you know what? I think like this isn't worth it for me as a coach.
Yeah.
How often do you deal with the athlete that might as well be writing their own training plan because they tell you what modifications need to be so often? And so like, hey, I don't really want to do the ski intervals. Mm-hmm. And I see that there wasn't this on the plan. And so can we make Mondays this, Tuesdays this, Thursdays this, and Saturdays this moving forward? And you're like, well, yes. But this is six deviations from what I believe you hired me for. Mm-hmm. And pretty soon people are, you're literally, I mean, and I've allowed it for months on end sometimes where it's like, I'm literally doing what you're telling me to tell you to do at this point. How often do you deal with that? Because I'll get somebody on occasion, right? It's very minority. You know exactly what I'm talking about. They're literally telling me how to write the programming for them because they know best. And maybe they do in some instances, but it's really frustrating.
Yeah. So much less than I used to.
Yeah. Isn't that nice?
For two reasons. One, this podcast. This podcast is like the greatest filter ever for athletes reaching out to work with us.
Well, and you build credibility. So you're not questioned as often because they probably have bought into how you think already.
That's it. They know what we believe in for the most part.
Yep.
Most people don't bother reaching out, having already listened to what I'm going to say, knowing what I'm going to say, and then hear me say it and be like, no, I don't want that. You already know. You listen. So that's helped a lot. And then the other half is just being more, much more selective of who I work with through the screening process. And it's like early on, the bad coaching habits we've talked about, I had to implement some of those, as do a lot of people, because you need money. Like early on, it was probably 50-50. The people I worked with, I didn't like half of them I really liked working with and half was a hassle every day, but I had to pay the bills. And so I needed to work with you. And luckily over time, it moved to 90-10 and now it's probably like 95-5. But that's been a process of mine has been, in fact, Rich reached out to me about a month ago and he said, hey, I have an athlete that I think would be better off with someone else. Do you have bandwidth right now? And my reply was, yes, but what type of athlete are they? Because I am trying to, like, you have the 90%, the 10% who take up 90% of your time. That's kind of like the business
That's how it is.
Yep. Industry standard. Mine's more like 5%. not 10 anymore. But I told him that exact thing. Like, I'm looking to remove that 10%. And he's like, I totally get it. Don't worry about it. This is not that type of athlete. But I screen for that now. Mm. So yeah. Luckily, less and less. But it still happens. You still get surprised by people. Some people, I'm okay with it when they know how to train well. And they will tell you what they need because they need you to tell them in order for them to get it done. Mm-hmm. I'm not okay with it when they have no clue and they are like little puppies, just anything that moves, they want to bark at it. And they need to tell you why. I really think what I need to be doing right now is like just like nonstop tempo runs. And like 2 weeks later, what I really need to be doing right now is nonstop right. VO2 max works. It was way too hard for me in the first mile last race. And now what I really need, and they just keeps telling you that and they have no clue. That's the one that drives me nuts.
Hmm. Well, I say above all else, people who are honest with me about how things are going, whether it's going good or bad, I love it when an athlete says, hey, I don't love this for them, but like stuff sucks. I've been sick or like I really effed up and I just couldn't do life this week and I missed. And then I say, great, I'm so sorry that's going on. Here's the deal. We don't lose fitness in a week. This is how I want to modify our next 10 days because you were communicating to me the bad as well as the good. I love a good celebration and we have a lot of them over here, but like somebody, the communication for me just comes down to like, hey, I can help you through this now. Like, I don't need to be your therapist and a couple of you lean on me as such, but at the same time, like just share it all. Yeah. Because I think we're best to help when things are unideal. That's really where you get your money's worth as a coach, as an athlete, sorry, that hires somebody. Everything can go great. You've had 6 months of nonstop great training. You've executed the workouts. You've been able to hit it. I don't care who you hire, their philosophy. You do something with purpose for 6 months, you're probably going to improve and be nearly happy right. with it. A coach earns their paycheck and you earn a relationship with that coach when the waters get muddy and you help navigate a complex race schedule together. But the only way that happens is through sharing the whole spectrum from a really bad situation or day or week or month to the really good. And so for me, it's just like, it is the one word still. And the word isn't over-communication because I have people who treat me like their friend and now we're bullshitting about the Packers game when I'm like busy. Like I can't talk about that. Like with you, who I just met a month ago as my athlete, like we shouldn't be discussing politics or something like that, which right. people try to do. So it is a fine line, but from that athlete spectrum.
Yeah.
Anyways, I just want to leave that like share it all. And I think like with in regards to your training in relation to life and we will be in a good place no matter what.
Right.
As far as a relationship goes.
Yeah. I say a version of this often to athletes who are unsure what level of communication is appropriate. If you think it more than once, I should be thinking it. And that can be as simple as just message me on Slack and say, hey, I've been wondering about this race. Or I kind of want to run a 5K in the fall. Or I think my calf's bothering me. A fleeting thought you don't need to tell me every time. But if you think it twice, that's enough. I should think it once. That's kind of how I think about it. If it's on your mind, I should be aware of it.
I like that. That's simple.
They don't all require a call to handle it or a novel. Sometimes it's just like you get the notice and I get to say back, unimportant, move on. And sometimes it's, hey, that's way more important than you might think it is right now. We absolutely need that. I'm so glad I heard.
And Bracken likes a good novel, though, guys, so don't hesitate, okay? He really likes a good novella. So really. Over-explain for sure in your engagement.
And Kirk likes late night texts.
What's late night, 8 p.m. or later?
Yeah, I'd say 9 or later. When he's laying in bed getting ready to sleep, he needs you to distract him.
I really do. All right, let's move on from that. That was a good question, though. All right, run and climb.
Actually, sit. I think that Dusty is a Dusty I work with. And that probably was, I assume so. It sounds like his type of reasoning and he's a delight to work with.
Dusty the Delight, we'll call him. All right. Run and climb. Hi. Question for the podcast. Can you give both takes against and for running a race that you don't feel ready for? Do your opinions change if the race result really matters to you? Thanks.
Yes. And yes.
And it depends.
Yep. there are some people who just need to find out. and they should always race. Sometimes you are pity partying and you're way more fit than you think. Sometimes you are overconfident and you need to get slapped in the face now. Sometimes you just need to know so you have direction for what's coming. And for those reasons, you just gotta race. It doesn't matter if you're like, if you're getting a little gun shy. I'm not going to do this race because the weather's bad. I'm not going to do this race because my fitness isn't perfect. I'm not going to do this because I missed 2 days last week. You just gotta race.
That's the end.
Yeah, just do it. Who cares if it's not your A+ best performance? Go race.
I think the answer is 85% yes to both. Yeah. With the 15% caveat being you're putting yourself at risk because the reason you're not ready is injury. That's the only 15% is where my head goes. Those who are afraid of the sun, meaning you're not in shape because you've been slacking. Well, let's rip the Band-Aid off and get a sunburn and go out there and push, because that's probably going to make your fitness better. The person who self-admittedly understands, like, I can't find a way to push like I know how unless there's other people next to me. So I feel like I live a little bit on the table in training. If the race is a stepping stone to your season and you know you'll be better for it, even if you'll be disappointed with the result, or in my case, which will probably be eventual, it's just been a while. And no, I'm not in my best fitness, but I know what happens when I race. And what happens when you race, folks, especially if you're not one who over races, is it usually levels you up one. You end up like able to take the sun a little better the next time when the next race is coming. So I think majorly yes should be the answer to both, barring we aren't monitoring an injury and that's why we're not ready.
Yeah. Yeah. What's to be gained? If you can't come up with a good reason to race, then don't race. Racing is supposed to be some amount of fun, even if the act of racing is not always fun. Mm-hmm. You should be looking forward to it a little bit, even if that feeling is fear. If you don't feel anything towards it, that's the time not to race.
That's why I think those with, I mean, I've struggled with it. You've struggled with it. Race anxiety. You struggle with race anxiety, like pretty bad? The answer is yes. Like, dull yourself to it, because you really, have you ever performed your best when you've been so keyed up for a race that it's consumed you for days and weeks and you're running just adrenal a little bit for a while? Like,
it kills you. It poisons you.
It poisons you. And so those who struggle with a bit of race anxiety, I think the answer is often yes, because you do end up not becoming numb to it. That we don't want to ever become numb to it, but you become settled with the process and the lead in. And I think that's also an important part. Maybe if you run on the race anxiety side, I would push you towards the yes button.
Any decision we make becomes easier to make in the future. And so saying no to a race because you don't feel like you're very fit makes it easier to make that same decision in the future if you're not perfectly fit. Like, there's a difference between not in shape and not in perfect shape, but that line moves closer and closer towards perfection each time you say no to it. And that is something I've struggled with myself, because I am not an athlete who, try as I might, I'm not an athlete who just loves the game so much that it doesn't matter where they finish. I just like being in the mix. And if I'm not in the mix, the race feels like a race. And that leads itself to, if I'm not ready to be in the mix, I shouldn't be there. And now it's, how do you accurately determine if you're ready to be in the mix? So for people like myself, you got to just go race. And you've given me that advice. Hunter's given me that advice. Lisa's given me that advice. These people who know me give me that advice. If you're like me, you probably can't use that as an excuse.
Yeah, and I've had a number of seasons where I've started out not ready, but have chosen to race. You know how those seasons end up, barring health isn't, you stay healthy? They end up really well. You find it, right? Yeah, you take your lumps early, but it gets you there way quicker. It just does. Yeah. So,
well, and if you're not in great shape to race right now, what are the reasons for that? It's either that you have had something disrupt you that was outside of your control and now you're making up for it, or it's you that disrupted your training. So if you're coming off of injury, that falls in line with what you said. It's not worth it. Like, why race right now? But if you need to get yourself in line here, a race is a wake-up call that sometimes is the thing to get you back in line. Like, your other things clearly aren't working. If you're not injured, you're not in shape because you haven't been consistent. Again, I am the choir here being preached to by myself. I have lived that. Sometimes a race where it doesn't, it reminds you why you can't do this and it doesn't go well. That's the thing that finally will change your pattern, is embarrassment or pain or blowing up or disappointment. Negative emotions can be really strong motivators.
How long do you think, literally, it can be as simplified as, like, if you haven't raced in 8 months, the answer is yes. Like, you've been fine. You just haven't picked anything out. Like, when do you stay away too long that, like, the answer should just be yes anyways, because it's like, you should try to stay in touch with it. I know this is a very subjective question, yeah, but let's say you enjoy racing and you've had seasons of life where you've been racing a lot and some little. You're like, I haven't run a race since last spring and it's now January and I'm training and listening to this stupid running podcast. Mm-hmm. I haven't raced at all. Is the answer just yes at some point, no matter what, just to do it? Or is that not necessary? Your wife would be somebody who doesn't race, but trains 40 miles a week. So there's other ends, but what do you think?
Yeah. I don't know what the time frame is, but if you have to ask, that's your answer. If you have to say, am I rusty? Yep, you are. Mm-hmm. Have I been away too? Yep, you are.
And hey, guess what? Guess who's in that boat?
You.
I'm feeling that way.
So I am in this boat right now for this weekend, Kirk. This weekend is the Abominable Snow Race. And I am trying to find out what's the fact and what's the excuse right now for me.
Hey, the temps are warming up a little, so that's not an excuse.
No, the way I'm looking at it is I'm not fit enough to even race as hard as I raced last year, which was not very fit last year either. So am I afraid of not being able to be up with the front people? Like, yeah, I am. But I also haven't touched an obstacle now in an entire year. I've only started running trails in the last 2 to 3 weeks after having an ankle tendon tear. And I rolled my other ankle on the trail Tuesday while babying my other one on my first descent in like 13 weeks. So is it safe and smart for me to go run a challenging technical obstacle course? Should I avoid it for that reason? Or am I just being a baby because I don't want to get beat? So like, this is a thing I still go through. Like, this is real. That's a good question.
Well, let me help you here. May I?
Yeah, you may.
Do any of your racing goals in the immediate 3 to 4 months involve OCR of any kind?
I don't think so. There might be one I can even make it to.
Then what is to be gained right now with that set of circumstances? I think if you have to ask, the answer is no. If this were to be a stepping stone towards something you care more about, mm-hmm, you could argue risking it. But in this domain, if it was a road race and you plan on running a half in 4 months, I'd be like, yeah, hop in the 5K. Who cares if you get your butt kicked? It's minimal risk. I would say the answer is no. It's not worth it. And it's not a stepping stone to what? What is it a stepping stone to?
Well, to training clarification, I think. It would tell me exactly what my engine's like right now. Last year, the race started at the bowl of a valley and we ran up out of the valley. And by the top, I was like, oh, I have not done enough work uphill at any sort of pace. It was all grindy stuff. Mm-hmm. I knew that. Like, I'll learn something in the first quarter mile. So in terms of what it says about what I've built in this like 2/3 training thing I'm doing right now, that would be beneficial. If it were a Spartan race, I wouldn't think twice. There's going to be like 6 or 7 technical rigs and hanging and swinging things that are my shoulders and back ready for this? I don't care if my grip gives out. I don't want to walk out of this with an injury. And unfortunately, that's my lens right now. So this is fact versus excuse. It's a real battle for, am I ready to race? I'm not looking for clarity on this. I'm just using it as an example.
The answer is usually no. Do we ever fully feel ready and prepared? Like, gosh, it's a very select few. Right. We're like, yep. Very select windows of the year. Should you actually be able to confidently say yes? At least that's how I generally am. Shall we move to the next one?
Let us.
I don't have the name of this human being. It's blocked out. Sorry about that. This came through the website. Hey, guys. Frequent listener to the podcast. Question for the next Q&A. For runners showing results on their own, when do you think is the best time to consider a coach? I've progressed from a 134 to a 119 half marathon in the last 2 years, and overall I'm happy with the results. Obviously, progress will get more challenging moving forward. So when would you recommend making a leap with a coach to pursue the next level?
I like that. I have very definite feelings on this. My take is that if you're improving and getting better at something that you already grasp the race, so or let's just say half marathon on the road, I grasp that. I've done it. I've trained for it. I understand the demands of it. Then when in doubt, book a consult with someone. Hear them talk about it and then decide, am I doing everything wrong and I could be way better? Or should I just keep riding this thing out until I get to the point where I just don't know better? I think that's the easy answer. Just talk to a coach one time. The time to for sure get a coach is when you are at a loss for what to do, or you are embarking on a challenge that you need someone else's opinion on that knows that challenge. So if this half marathoner decided to go to an ultra or to the 5K or to the maybe a marathon, something they have no idea of what the challenge really requires, that's when you go to a coach. But if you're already doing great, roll for a while and get some advice and see how crazy different from what you're doing that advice really even is.
First of all, congratulations. 134 down to 119 is astounding progress. 15 minutes, you're taking off over a minute per mile within a two-year span. You're probably on the right track. Yeah. I would say safe to say, and you got some talent. Not only that,
20 is not anything to scoff at.
No, you got some talent. So, first of all, that would be a worthwhile investment for you to get some outside eyes on this, no matter how well things are going. I think, okay, you like it. You've progressed well, and I would call you a talent, I would say. And so that might be worth just the consult call to say, hey, you're on the right track. I think you can get away with this until you feel like you've stagnated or, maybe could you have gotten down to 115? You don't even know it. The question is going to remain. Just because you improved doesn't mean all boxes are covered. But at the same time, you know your body as well or better than anybody else possibly could. So what is it like as little as you can apply in order to improve is what you should apply in order to improve. So if we can ride this train out and you have Father Time on your side, maybe you ride this until you have a handful of halves that are all within the same ballpark. Fine. But our process is you inquire about, hey, I'm potentially thinking about a coach. We say, great, answer some questions for us and we'll hop on a call. And we hop on a call and we talk. And sometimes, like I have told people, you don't need me right now. Maybe reach out in a year. And I've also said, like, I can help you. I can really help you. The fact that you got down to 119 and what you're doing is absolutely mystifying. Let's get you on some real training. Like, you could get either answer.
Yeah.
But the fact you're listening to a podcast, absorbing information about running, probably tells me you're probably well on your way to some really good programming already. So that's not a clear answer whatsoever, but the curiosity itch can be scratched if you're curious. There's no committing. It's not like you need to commit to anything to reach out and inquire. You know, I even get to the point now, and I've thought it a few times about like, I feel like I know myself pretty well, but like, I'm wondering if I would benefit from outside eyes just because we only know what we only know, and a fresh set of eyes on something. Having you coach me, Bracken, or having who knows coach me might be exactly what I need to, let's say, sub 15, or somebody say, Kirk, you need to race the 5K in March and then again in April. And here's when I want you to do it. And like, just be like, okay, yes, I'll follow rules. I'm a good direction follower. Even something as simple as that, like, well, hey, we should have a 5K 4 weeks out from your half, and we should race two 10Ks somewhere in here as well. Let's overspeed this thing so that marathon pace feels comfortable. You know, like these outside conversations that are all outside of the programming even may end up leading you to a better result as well.
Yeah.
I'm talking a bit in circles, but you understand what I'm getting at. There's other aspects to this other than the script itself.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a call with someone a couple of weeks ago and I said, listen, I'll work with you, but I think you need a sounding board more than you need a coach. I'll happily help with this process, but I think you just need someone to check in with like once a quarter. You're writing good training plans. You might just need confirmation that you're doing it right and then ask the little questions that you can't ask anyone in your circle. Sometimes you'll just find out confirmation of what you're doing.
It's also very valuable, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, because then the guesswork's done. All right, I'm doing fine. Let's ride it out.
Yeah.
What's the best training plan in the world, Kirk?
Like the one that you follow consistently.
Yeah, the one you can do consistently and the one you believe in.
Yep.
From there, if you can do multiple versions like that, then there are conversations to be had. But if you're consistent, you're healthy, you're improving, and you believe in it, that's the only secret there is.
Yeah, I think there's just like, in the self-coaching realm, especially if you're newer to the space, I'm assuming this person improved 15 minutes in 2 years. I'm guessing they're newer to the running space with that kind of improvement.
Yeah.
There's probably not a ton of confidence in what they're like describe because they just haven't had the opportunity to earn that confidence over decades of it. So it depends what kind of camp you fall in, how new of an athlete or tenured of an athlete you are. But should we move to the next one?
I do want to.
But
that prompted something that I think I screenshot something. I might have even sent it to you. But it was like the add-on to the end of a question. Maybe we're even going to get to it today. But someone said, Kirk, when are you finally just going to actually allow yourself the chance to run a proper 5K? Like good weather, set up to actually do well. Mm-hmm. Like be fair to yourself and run one in good weather. Like it's time. You've earned a sub 15. Just go do it now. And I mm-hmm. thought that was really good. That was one of those like direct statements we need mm-hmm. to hear sometime. Like, I think it's time. So I liked hearing that from them, and I wanted you to hear it in case we didn't get to that today.
I saw that. Of course I saw that.
Good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I got a spicy 5K, USATF certified. I'm going to get my butt whooped locally coming up. Well, not coming up. We're still frozen here, but as soon as it unthaws a little bit. Yeah, working through a little bit of a niggle or a nagle right now that I got to sort out first. all right. Tyler asks. Q&A question. I run World's Toughest Mudder 2 weeks ago. Must have meant ran. I ran World's Toughest Mudder 2 weeks ago, and my heart rate has been about 10 to 15 beats per minute higher, and I've had a hard time getting my restorative sleep since the event. I decided to take training off until December, but I am concerned when going back. How do you recommend approaching the next 4 to 6 weeks?
Trust fall. This is the classic thing. Like, I know I need to do blank, but I'm worried it'll cost me. Like, my friend, it is already costing you. Trying to work through it is going to cost you more than you could ever lose by taking a month off. Because at least it's done and dusted if you take the month off. Yes, you have lost a little bit, but it's done. Clean slate, move forward. Working through it just extends the time to when you're going to have to take time away. And now you could have been through it already and you're not. So I don't have a good scientific, oh, don't worry, you won't lose it. Yeah, you're going to lose a little bit and you're going to gain it all back. If you did the work needed to get ready and through WTM, it's going to come back quick because you've put in so much work already.
I've worked with Tyler many years ago.
Okay.
He's been grinding pretty hard for years and years and years. Let's say he's always got goals. He's always pursuing, big things. He's been training with high purpose for, let's call it 5 or more years to just give you some confidence in what you just recommended to him. The second thing, do you remember the second time Robert Killian won the Spartan Race World Championships? Do you remember how that season went for him?
I do.
Do you remember how it began?
Yep.
Robert Killian took, I don't know, 4 to 8 weeks. He said, I am in the dirt. Everything I can, my physiological metrics and how I am doing is not going well. I am so burnt to a crisp. He took 4 to 8, I don't remember, Robert, if you listen. And he showed up to the first race of the year in his third week back to training in March. Mm-hmm. And he recognized the world champion, one of the highest, his top end potential maybe is higher than anybody in our sport when he's on. And he took his lumps early. He even had races he had to get to right after coming back. And he got whooped. And he got whooped and he came along. But the main thing was when it mattered come end of September, no way would he have been a Spartan Race World Championship in arguably the deepest era of Spartan Race. If he hadn't gone and had the foresight in January and February to listen to his body and say, hey, it's only January and February. You got to chill if you're not feeling well. And I mean, not every story has a fairy tale ending like that, but I can guarantee you it wouldn't end like that if he didn't take it when his intuition told him to take it off. So letting him be an example, you're making the right decision. Yep. I'm guessing your return to training by the time we got this. You sent us this on November 24th, Tyler. And he asked how to approach the next 4 to 6 weeks. I think he is inferring like his first 4 to 6 weeks back. And my answer to that is a very slow ramp up. You do not need to pick up where you left off in your overreaching phase to WTM. Tyler, maybe you run 3 or 4 days in a total of 20 miles your first week back. And then you do that again your second week back. And then maybe you go to 25 miles your third and fourth week back. And you take your time. Let your body tell you it's ready. And you don't swing for the fences in any quality. And you don't do these long, crazy long runs comparatively to what you had done previously. And you just give yourself like a 6 to 8 week slow and gradual ramp up and feel it out as you go. It's a long year. That's how I'd recommend it.
That's exactly it. The only plus side to losing fitness is now your body responds better to smaller chunks of workouts.
Yep.
Like if at your height you were doing 100 mile weeks and an 80 mile week would have felt like a loss in fitness, and now you've lost fitness, now an 80 mile week is going to do something for your fitness, and also a 60 mile week might. So that's your saving grace. You lost fitness. Great. You get to do less and still improve right now on your way back.
Yeah. Tyler could have used this advice about 2 months ago, but
yep.
Whoops. Dog ears.
Dog ears.
Next question, Damien. Damien says, gentlemen, I have a listener question here for you about strength training. What does your strength training look like in the 2 months leading up to a race? Are you still hitting the big lifts pretty hard 1 or 2 times a week and getting close to your max on one of the sets? Or are you dialing back all your reps, sets, and weight in some way to minimize fatigue so you can run more and be fresher for the workouts? Thanks, Damien.
It's a good question. This is one of those things that if you go to a strength and conditioning professional, they are really going to harp on the importance of priming your race performance through strength training, where we need to, as the race gets closer, we move away from certain types of sets and we move into more explosive work and long rest and making sure that all systems are converging as one. And if you talk to more of a running-based strength expert, they're going to tell you, do that as a runner and let the strength training remain as unchanged as possible for the preventative benefits, the structural benefits, and the overall chemical changes it can provide to your body. And if we need to reduce sets from 3x5 down to 2x5, let's do that. But 2 months out, we're not going into sharpening, priming phase of strength training. We're doing that with our running. And Kirk and I are going to be more of one camp than the other for sure.
Well, explain it.
Well, we believe if you're going to be sharpening or if you're going to be really playing with intensity and modifying reps and sets, it should be on the running front. That we don't believe any one system of strength training is going to make you an Olympic marathon champion.
Darn.
But if you want to make it to the start line, you should be doing some sort of strength training. And since we are not looking at it from a pure performance standpoint, we do not need to periodize our strength training as intensely as we need to periodize our running. But we just need to modulate the stress it has on our body so we can complete the run training that we need to get done. So 2 months out, I'm not changing much.
Yeah, I very much agree with all of that. I would say, let's say he asks about like you're 2 months out from a race. So let's assume it is an A race, right? This is your big show, your big dance.
Yep.
As a general rule of thumb, as we periodize our running and let's say the intensity of sessions maybe peak, let's say 3 to 6 weeks out of something we really care about, coupled with volume, I just don't like to add extra load on the strength front that is going to compromise my ability to run. And so the answer is not to add more, first of all. I would say that the answer is to do less in the form of volume on the strength front, meaning either reduce reps is how I look at it. Instead of sitting in a higher rep strength endurance phase, that may lead to a little more DOMS. I just lower the rep counts and stay more available for my running that matters. So generally, if an A race approaches, you'll see the rep ranges and rep schemes of my lifts decrease. So instead of 10, I might go down to 8, and then I might go down to 5, and I'm using a little more weight, but the sheer volume of my lifting is going down. What I mean by that is on the rep range. Yeah. Just because you can't increase both at the same time without risking one taking away too much from the other. They can work cohesively. It's just I generally double down on the power output. Yep. And I back off the strength endurance because we're going to get so much of that effort level on the run front. And we should be doing a little more powerful type running depending on the event you're training for. And so general rule of thumb, it all stays in there. And then what I tend to do, if it is my A race, it is my A race, I may back off a set or two the week prior, and then I may back off 20% of the weight the week of. So I have like a little mini taper in, but I'm still showing up and going through the motion of the movements. I'm just reducing the exposure to those movements. That's how I would do it.
I like it. I had someone explain it to me once from a performance standpoint for a ball sport athlete or a sprinter, that you start with your big movements and you build absolute power, and then you move to more sport specific movements. So now you're going to single leg as you get closer to race day, so that you can transfer all that power into the exact motion you're going to be able to use it for. And you need to get more explosive and dynamic as you sharpen so that you can use it all when it matters. And that's good. But we're doing that with our running.
Correct.
You're doing that with your downhill work. You're doing that with your uphill work. You're doing that with your speed work. So actually, if anything, I would do the reverse. I would use my single leg and my explosive stuff in the off season when I'm not doing big, nasty downhill workouts and track sessions. And I'd move more towards just 3x5s in the meat and potatoes of my season. And when I get 2 months out, I might keep it like that and go down to 3x3s. And then 2 weeks out, I might go 2x3s. But I'm not getting cute with my lifting. I'm making sure that it doesn't get in the way of my cute running. Sharpening your lifts into plyos is going to help your downhills less than sharpening your downhills are going to help, because you've already built the resistance through the weight training up into that point.
Yeah. The more complex your running gets, the less complex your lifting should get.
There are only two times I would argue any different. That would be certain types of ultras and Hyrox or Decafit.
Sure.
But that's not what we're talking about right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Your butt's keeping heavy lunges in there no matter what, you Hyrox fools. All right. Yep. Blake, two-parter, two screenshots. So bear with me here. Don't know where we're going with it. Blake says, right to the point, Q&A question. I feel like my running fitness is starting to peak. I've done some time trials and I've got a few PRs in the last couple of weeks, which is cool. But as we head into the typical off season, is this a good time to take a break or double down and take advantage of peak fitness and train at faster paces while they feel relatively easier? Once again, love your podcast. I try to listen to several others, but they are not as good as yours. They either try and impress people with too much information and therefore become very confusing, or they've read a few books and do not fully understand the concepts themselves. But you guys break it down on a practical level so I can understand and take action. Thank you. Now, I guess there's a part two. I didn't need to read that paragraph.
But I'm glad you did.
Me too. Thank you, Blake.
Listener of the week?
Blake. Blake, part two of my confusion. I love doing slow base runs, tend to do a lot in zone one or two, but recently have trained for a 5K, so shorter, faster runs. So do I take the typical off-season base building approach, or as you guys said in your monster episode, take this winter and become a monster at faster paces? That's okay. The Monsters in the Dark episode from last New Year's that you did alone?
I don't think so. When I think it's the what would make you a monster or something like that.
Okay.
I was going to give a different answer right up until the point he said he just trained for a 5K. I was going to say, do we know if you're peaking or not? Like, maybe your fitness is just leveled up. And right. At that point, you don't need to back off. But if you just trained for a 5K, there's a chance like you did kind of reach a mini peak here. But I don't think you have to choose one or the other. I think you don't want to lose one or the other. You've had success because you've done a great base build in the past, and you're fast right now because you've done good 5K pace work and speed. So don't get rid of the base work, but don't let the speed work go entirely. Take a portion of that into your off season and dose it as well as you can at a level that has no consequences. So stay in touch with it. Let's just say, for example, you were running 8x800 at 5K pace during this peaking build phase you did. That's a weird concept, peaking build. This build towards a 5K that peaked you. Run a few 800s. Run two or three of them a few times a week in addition to one of your runs, or run some fours or twos at that. Not real work, but keep in touch with what you've done. You can even do five of them, six of them. That's still a huge reduction in the work you've done. As long as you're not doing it quite as frequently or quite as long, then you're in no risk. So I would bring them both along for the ride.
My guess is that as a regular listener to the podcast, and you could go listen to how we think about the off-season episode we did 2 weeks ago and pretty much glean from our recommendations there with stay in touch. Maybe you literally on a Tuesday, that's a quality day for you, let's say. You do a warm up, you hit 4x400 faster than 5K pace, and then you go run a 7 mile extended tempo threshold cool down type effort, and voila, you got it. But we're not doing 16x25 and filling the volume bucket there, and you're just staying in touch. But go ahead and lean into your base phase run enjoyment and give you just enough sprinkles so that when it comes March and you have an April road race, you can go right to the big work and be ready for it.
Yep.
Yep.
The good way to think about this is think of your best sessions you did or your favorite sessions that got you feeling like this, and then say, what would the smallest portion of this that I could do? What would that be that would make me feel like I've done anything at all? And just do that workout as your off-season workout. When we talked about becoming a monster in the off-season, if I remember correctly, we talked about going in on a thing. If I just did this for the next 3 months, what would I be afterwards? And that thing can't be sustained intense work. It can be constant skill work at speed. It can be big downhill work, big uphill work, lots of volume, lots of long run, but it can't be 3 months of sustained speed work. But it can be many doses of that sustained. So you can't just go in on 5K work all off season and be a 5K monster. And I think you obviously know that. But there's a version of that that you can keep in there.
It makes me think this is very tangential and probably not helpful for anybody, but I'm going to say it anyway. So we've mentioned, I ran these Twilight 5000 series races the last couple of years, and a name that was from the WEAC, Phil Rickard, had raced against me, and he'd a very accomplished athlete in the 5K, 10K cross country. Anyways.
Do you know that he anchored the DMR the year we went from second to last on the last leg, my senior year of track, and they won? He brought them from like fifth to first.
Well, anyways, we've had a chance to race a little bit, but and then I have another former teammate from college, Dave Krzyzewski, who's like 43 and a monster. I mean, he just ran a 5:17 tempo run in prep for his marathon, and his tempo meaning like heart rate was chilling in the lower 140s. For him, he's ready to go run. Like, he wants to chase maybe 222. Anyways, I'm getting at something here. I see Strava. We all look at it. And I see David Krzyzewski Strava, and he's in 55 degrees and 0 mile an hour winds. And he lives in California, and it's wonderful. And I'm like, oh, I get a little bit of envy. Like, man, that running would be nice. And he's running quick. And I'm a little, good job, David. That's how I feel. And then I see Phil posting selfies with icicles hanging from his eyebrows in negative 10, running only 6x800 at very average pacing. You want to know who I'd be afraid to race in 4 months? Phil, the guy who's running way slower and way less volume in crap conditions, who is just gritting it out, doing the non-sexy stuff right now because of what's going to come next. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know where I'm going with that, other than you often say, like, when you see what other people are doing, who would you be afraid to race? The guy who's been doing a bunch of base work, or the guy who's been ripping 400 since December? I'd be afraid of the guy with a bunch of base work. I'm afraid of the guy with icicles from his beard running 800 meter repeats in negative 10 degrees, because that does something to you. And I think most of us would say, if somebody went in and put a bunch of mileage in that wasn't that flashy, I'd be much more scared of them down the road than I would somebody who's doing all the sexy work in December. Now, to my teammates David's credit, he has races that really matter coming up. So he's trying to peak for something. He's doing exactly what he should. But all that to say is, I don't know, think about it that way. You use that example a lot. What would you be afraid of racing if you knew what your competition was doing? Icicle man.
And when in doubt in the off season, you choose the option that gives you options when the off season is done.
Right.
If you go in on the 5K a lot now, or whatever your thing is, but it's intensity, your options are less. And one of them might be a break. If you go in on that base building, but I'm going to dose some speed and I'm going to be ready for whatever comes next, anything can come next after that.
Right. Right. If you've eaten dessert first, dinner's not going to be very good.
Right.
Let's time look at it. All right. This is one of my favorite. We've had a question from this next guy once before, I think. And he sent it to me and you via email, and it just warms my heart. And I just love it. You'll see why when I get through it, but it's a couple hefty paragraphs. So bear with me.
Okay.
And he says, feel free to leave this first part out. You asked, so I answered. I'm not leaving the first part out. It's important. Gents, I have another question for you, but first a little info about surf ski. Do you remember this person?
I do remember the surf ski question.
Yeah. For all intents and purposes, surf ski is the same as the sprint kayaking you see in the Olympics. Somehow we had talked about this stuff, I think.
Someone had asked about a surf ski time trial and how often they can do that.
Yeah, something like that.
They do it every single like Wednesday night or whatever.
Right. But it is done in the ocean and the races are usually 1 to 2 hours long. Despite the sport looking like an arm sport, it's a whole body sport with an emphasis on legs and torso rotation. Rowing would be the most comparable sport in terms of body stress and fitness you'd be familiar with. You asked how I found your podcast. There's very little podcast available, and none of them go into the weeds about training as yours does. Also, I do an even more obscure sport called surf life saving. Surf life saving consists of surf ski, swimming, running, and prone board paddling. Don't ask because we will all be here for all day. In this sport, there are four disciplines to train for at the same time. I often listen to triathlon podcasts because they help me understand how to balance training for the different disciplines. I found and enjoy your podcast because you have a lot of content about hybrid and obstacle course training, which is also trying to balance different skills and disciplines into a training program. And no, there are even fewer podcasts and content about surf life saving and even surf ski. My training buddy and I both listen to your podcast, so you at least have two surf ski paddler loyal listeners. And that warms my heart, Matt. So now to the questions. We can all agree that science tells you the fastest way to run your PR is to negatively split. But this is not the reality of a race. I swear I have heard one of you specifically say you should negatively split training sessions, but not the race. I would say this is a very common opinion in the training world in general. You did an episode on how important it is to stay with the lead pack, even if the pace is too fast, because if you don't, you will get dropped. This exact thing is what happens in all real racing. The beginning of the race is always faster, then it settles, and then the final fast kick at the end. You both have said many times that you should train for what the race demands. So, why would we ever negatively split the workout? Shouldn't we always start a workout faster, slower in the middle, and hard push to the end? Wouldn't it be beneficial to train our body to handle that, since this is exactly what will happen in a race? It seems to me there should be a distinction between training to run your fastest time and training to race. Matt. That's a good one.
That's a very good one. And the answer is you're entirely correct, but it doesn't mean you're always accurate on this. And we have gone through this ourselves. But what you're describing is basically the conundrum for anyone who trains track athletes, which is you have to get in shape to run your fastest time, and then you have to be ready for a championship race. And they are two different styles of training. So the best way I can describe this to you is that if you want to be able to handle fast starts, fast finishes, the best way you can handle that is by having the highest possible capacity of work. In our sport, we would call that anaerobic and aerobic capacities. Some people would focus more on VO2 max, but it really doesn't matter. If you have those standards pushed as high as you possibly can, then you will tolerate a fast start and a fast finish better. The concept of working really hard and then getting used to working at a heightened state of fatigue at a slower pace is really a skill. It's not an engine component. It's a skill that can be learned in like 3 to 6 weeks, less by some people. And so you want to come in with the biggest possible engine and then teach it to function in different formats. And so in the track world, that looks like get faster, raise my threshold, get faster, raise my threshold. And then when championship season starts coming up, now we start structuring one of our sessions per week with some fast starts and some fast finishes. So it does need to be there, but in a much smaller percentage than maybe you're implying it would need to be there.
Could not explain how I feel about that better.
Nice.
Yeah. First of all, Matt is exactly correct about the specificity being needed, but what does that look like? That looks like 90% of your build doesn't include these go out hot, slow in the middle, fast finish. We build fitness foundationally, as we said, because that is our rock. That is what we have to fall back on, whether we go too easy, too hard, or perfectly, right? So the fitness is fitness. And you can look at it two ways, Matt. Let's say you have a busy racing season. Gosh, our collegiate track seasons, we raced a bunch. That can sort of check that box for you. Yeah, you might not be quite prepared to go out hot that first race of the year, but by your 15th race of the year when it's nationals, the racing has actually trained that into you. And so mm-hmm. we still work foundation in training. Let's say it is your first race of the year, but it happens to be an A race and it matters. Right as Bracken said, 3-4 weeks out, you teach to the test. But you don't teach to the test when it's 12 weeks out or 10 weeks out or 8 weeks out. You just work foundation until it's time for those finishing touches, the icing to be put on the cake. And then the argument which you're making, Matt, is like super, super valid. If you follow a mainstream track season or maybe your racing season, your surf ski season, I don't know what that looks like. If you're okay being just a little behind the eight ball so you can extend out your true fitness building for longer by racing yourself into race shape, that's often what we even mean by race shape. What is race shape? My fitness is good, but I'm not familiar with the story of the race yet. Mm-hmm. I can be as fit as I've ever been, but not be in race shape. And people get that confused. So you could race yourself into race shape, sticking to principles, and let that be it. Or you could try to simulate in training. Exactly. Fast start is more important than the fast finish, in my opinion. Go blow your doors out a little early and then force yourself to do a good bit of work after. The fast finish is either going to be there or it's not, I feel like. But I'm really echoing what you said, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a challenge. But it also is a little over-glorified. Because the people who are winning are generally not the people leading the fast start. And so not only do they have the highest anaerobic and aerobic capacities and maybe the highest potential, they're going out at a smaller percentage of what the other people who fall off that pace are going out at. And so if you look at the mile, the 1500, the 5K, the 10K, oftentimes the leaders are sitting in like 6th through 10th for a bit and then moving up. So their swing is actually smaller than the people getting dropped.
Right.
All of that comes down to what's your capacity to begin with. And the more capacity work you do, the more you're intimately acquainted with effort and pacing. So I see them as symbiotic, not working at odds with each other. But I do believe, we talked about this for OCR itself. When Warrior Dash World Championships came on, I did nothing but fast start workouts for 3 weeks prior to the event. Because we had 2, 3, 4 athletes in the field that had run at the Olympic trials. And this was going to be a 5K race with like 15 piddly obstacles. It was going to be fast. And it was. The first mile had like 80 feet of elevation gain. And I came through in 5:26 in like 52nd place. And this was all off road. This was a fast race. And I did nothing but that for 3 weeks leading into it. And it was very effective. Made the podium that race. It was great, but it came on the edge of 12 weeks of 10K paced work.
Fitness is still fitness. I think that's what it comes down to. Yeah. But again, if you're looking to the very pointy tip of the spear and you want to execute and be ready, what you're talking about, Matt, is very applicable.
Yep.
Chad asks,
actually, you know what? I'm not done with that.
Okay.
We are too emotional as humans. We don't run fast enough to have draft become such an important thing that if you lose the pack, you never catch it. But we're too emotional for that. So I don't even believe you have to go with the pack. I don't. Now, maybe in water sports you need to because of the wake. Draft is maybe more of a thing. But even on the track at the Olympic level, losing the draft of the pack is not going to be a deal breaker if you're fit enough. Like if you can just run metronome strides and stay mentally in it and excited, you'll catch up to the pack. Yeah. Only time I recommend going out harder than you need to is in OCR sometimes, where obstacle technique and technical running can happen at the same effort, but you're not seeing how people are moving through and taking a line, and thus you can't match it. That's the only time. I truly believe there's more opportunity to go out even splitted than most people give credit for. Now I'm done.
Nice little bookmark on that.
I was watching West Virginia yesterday, Kirk. I pulled up my first OCR race in months while I was on the treadmill.
Are you going to race Abominable?
I have no clue.
I have Kate, an athlete I've worked with for a while, coming from California to go run the Abominable.
Uh-huh.
I said, Kate, you're dang lucky Abominable is this weekend. It wasn't last weekend, because I don't know if anybody would survive.
That was rough. I have two kids home from school this week on antibiotics, so I don't even know. I don't know what life's going to hand me for Saturday morning.
Fair.
More excuses.
Those are also facts. Chad says, Q&A episode question. Aiden G. Troutner of BYU was the first person to ever break 4 minutes at the indoor track on the BYU campus. He finished at 3:59.2, I think. I'm curious to know how much more difficult to do is that than even an outdoor 4 minute mile at the same elevation. The indoor track there is 5 laps for a mile and is said to be a pretty tight turn. Sometimes people adjust times for elevation and say such and such time is equivalent to another such and such time at elevation. Could you hazard a guess at the equivalent outdoor mile time at both the same elevation in Provo, Utah, as well as adjusted for sea level?
First of all, they do have conversions for indoor track. The standard distances for indoor track or standard track types are 200 meters and 300 meters, and then there's flat and banked. And so the NCAA has a calculator, as does World Athletics, which converts 200-meter flat times to 300-meter times and 300-meter to 200 and banked versus not banked, and then it can convert it to outdoor. But 5 laps to a mile is an oversized indoor track. That's a 300-meter track. That's a 1,500-meter indoor is 300 meters. Now, I don't know if theirs is exactly 300, but even if it's a tight turn 300, that's probably better than a 200-meter track. And my belief is that a good indoor flat 200-meter track is high 90s in as fast as an outdoor 400-meter track in good weather. So a 300-meter track or a bank 200, I believe, is as fast or even slightly faster for a mile.
Well, and you could correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe I'm putting my foot in my mouth. Maybe I'm not. But I am 90% sure that the NCAA system also has an altitude conversion. If you go to Flagstaff and run a fast indoor mile, they may give you 3 seconds on time. You run 357 at 7,200 feet. Guess what? Now you just ran 353 high as far as we're concerned, and that's your time entered. So there are elevation and altitude conversions. That are also taken into account, because you have things like people go race in Colorado and they're at 5,300, or you go some, there's Arizona races, and plenty of those Western and Pacific schools at elevation, especially in the Rockies. So point being is that there's a system in place for this, and it's tiered, right? It's like this elevation to this gives you this much per mile, and that they have a whole system, and believe it's backed by science in some capacity. So there is, it's not such and such is like a such and such. It's quantifiable. According to science. So that does exist. But he asks, okay, what's 359? Let's just give him our get, you know, what's 359? We could plug into a calculator, but what is 359 at what is BYU at?
5,000-ish? 5,800? I'll pull it up.
Okay. So what do you think that conversion is? 359 indoor track.
I'm going to go to the conversion.
And I'll tell you what, Bracken, I would much rather five laps on an indoor track versus 4 laps on an outdoor track, because there is no wind indoors. It is perfect conditions every time. I argue you'd run faster on a 5 lap indoor track versus 4 laps on an outdoor track with wind elements.
Yeah. I agree with you. I mean, we've run indoor. A good indoor track feels faster than an outdoor track.
I agree.
And there's no wind, temperature is controlled. The only place you lose time, in theory, indoor track is on a tighter turn. And if it's banked or it's not that tight, you're not really losing anything. Mm-hmm. My senior year, I ran 357 for the 1500, which is like a 415 mile, 414, 415. Indoor, I ran 418 in the full mile on a 200 meter flat track. It's 3 seconds different, and I was absolutely 3 seconds fitter outdoors. So in my mind, they're equivalent. Every year you see people run 349 or 350 in the mile indoors that never really match or exceed much better than that outdoor in the 1500.
Yep. So what's the conversion? Did you find it?
Nope, I don't have it. I do know that when McCauley ran a 159.1 or 159.3 in an 800 at 6,800 feet of elevation in Colorado, NCAA calculator at the time gave him a 156.9.
So two plus seconds.
It was 2+ seconds in an 800 meter at just under 7,000 feet.
I was going to give it 3 seconds, give or take. If you say it's 5,000 feet, maybe that's a 356. 55?
Yeah, I'd say 55, 56 sounds good.
That's basic.
But indoor-outdoor, I think, is it's a wash.
All right.
10K, I'd rather run outdoor.
I agree with you.
Mile? Honestly, I might even take indoor over outdoor.
I've never seen an indoor 10K.
They shouldn't exist.
I don't think they do. Although there might be a 10K indoor race walk, but let's leave that to the birds.
I watched your co-alum, Andrew Voss, run 13:59 at Whitewater's indoor 200-meter track, and I said, yep, I'd even run a 5K indoor. That's fast.
That's quick. I never liked that surface, at least when I was running there.
Sorry, Whitewater. It was 14:59, not 13:59. Hmm. He broke 15, and that was a kid I had competed against in high school, and he went to Oshkosh then.
Yes, he did. Chewy. Chewy's an athlete I've been working with for a while now, down south. I think you guys might have got a little snow recently. Hope you're surviving, Chewy. All right. He asked a question in an email in one of our check-ins. He says, I have a question. This could also be a good one for the TRP podcast. I broke my nose in high school and have trouble inhaling equally from both nostrils. When I train without a nasal strip, I notice it's harder to breathe. But when I race with one, my performance improves significantly. It feels like an extra lung. Should I train with the nasal strip to improve training performance or train without it to push my body harder and adapt? Feliz Navidad, coach. That's what he says. On December 24th.
All right. So there's the question of comparison or best practice. The comparison of running with and without one is always going to benefit you if you don't train with one and you race with one.
Yep.
You will always, by comparison, feel much better. But the science of oxygen restriction versus oxygen reduction says that there's no real benefit cardiovascularly from reducing the size of the air passageway because you don't reduce the percent of oxygen you're taking in. Now, if you want to strengthen your lungs, sure, that's all well and good, but I wouldn't do it on quality days because then you'd actually be reducing the benefit of the quality day because you'd have to go slower.
I would be, I'd be doubling up on your nasal strips around the house, Chewy. Yeah, I would, at minimum, long runs, quality sessions, or speed work, or things of importance, and then races. If you want to go on your recovery efforts just because you like to have that contrast, it's like putting on your squishy shoes with no return and your super shoes on quality days. I would recommend, at least on the days where you need oxygen, when you're grabbing for it pretty good because the intensity is higher, wear the nasal strips. You're going to get more adaptation that way. That's it, pure and simple.
I also have never met some, I don't know your financial or insurance situation, but I've never met someone who regretted getting their nasal passageway fixed. Whether it's deviated septum, whether it's broken nose, no matter what it is, life gets better for everyone afterwards.
I agree. Should we just leave that one? That simple?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's do one or two more. We just have maybe, I don't know, 5 or so minutes left. Who is this from? I don't know. This is from one of the athletes I work with. I just don't have the person. But anyways, this is directed at you, I believe. Very good closing podcast for the year. Reminded me of a thought I wanted to drop for Bracken that I'm sure he has thought of. And maybe a good Q&A topic. When, and maybe more importantly, why to get a coach instead of do it yourself? Man, there's a theme with these, isn't there? There always is one. Mm-hmm. It's the third coaching question. I hired a coach for one reason. Objectively, an insight to blind spots. Not because I didn't know how to research and build a training plan. I think many people train themselves and fall short of their goals or go through the train, injury, recover, repeat cycle, and can't figure out why.
They can be very talented and subject matter experts, but are too close to the subject of themselves to objectively train themselves in the best way for them. Point in case, know any Olympic podium finishers without a coach? When should a person say enough and hire that independent third-party expert? Food for thought for Bracken, and maybe yourself, Kirk, and for the audience.
Yeah, I believe when you can't do it alone, you get someone on board. I think it's as simple as that. I still think someone like that is more in need of a mentor, a consult, something like that to oversee it. If you know how to build it, you like building it, build it. Have someone see those blind spots, but they don't need to do it on a daily basis. That'll probably give you more legs to do it long term. And I've heard, and this person's not wrong, they're repeating what they've heard, but coaches love using that. Tell me the last time there's a world champion or Olympian or world podium that didn't have a coach. Well, that's a requirement of being on the team and of the sponsorship. Like, you get signed by Nike, you join a Nike training group, and you have this coach. That's in the contract. You really can't get there without it. But there are constant examples of people getting into that level and beating those people without a coach, and then they get snapped up. Like Chrissy Wellington, one of the greatest triathletes of all time, she on a borrowed bike won her first world championship. Like, she just got there with no sponsors, no real coaching, was just doing her club riding, doing her thing. And then she was so good that people threw money at her and she got a coach. So like, she could have done it, but that pathway doesn't really exist. So I don't think a coach is necessary. And I say that as a coach. But when you need it, then it's great.
But how do you know you need it, right? No, you don't. It can be fuzzy. I have somebody, actually a couple people, I would say, over the last few years. I hope I don't make anybody feel called out, but I've been stagnant with my 5K improvement for the last year and a half, and it's time to get new eyes on it. I've been training like this for 2 years, and this is my setup, and Now I want your help. Well, we get 4 months in, and there's been 2 vacations where they refused to train. Oh, the holidays got in the way. I couldn't do this. Suddenly I got stressed with my job, and so I missed Monday through Thursday this week. And you go, I can see as clear as day. You had no issues with your training plan. Is this normal for you? In the last 4 months, have you missed 4 to 5 weeks of training or broken training because you came up with reasons to? Well, no shit, you haven't improved. Your objective view of the situation is wrong. You probably were doing all the right. How common is it for you to say, I'm going to push it off to tomorrow. I didn't get my long run in because I had family in from out of town. And now suddenly I'm thinking, well, you only needed me to hold you accountable. I'm not a genius. Your objective view of what you think you're doing is not true. You told me that you're training a certain way for the last year and a half. We get 4 to 6 months in and I see all the holes in this thing. You are so close to it, you can't even see that you're the problem with your own programming. And so that's a side view of how many people delusion themselves into the fact that I've been doing everything, but you haven't. And I don't know how often you found this, but people will tell you how their training has been. And then you get to working with them and you're troubleshooting every 10 days about why something was missed or this. And you go, what really has been going on here for the last year?
Right.
Do you know what I'm getting at here? And so first of all, that person, maybe they're living in their own delusion. When I'm on, I'm training like this, but I'm often off. Right. Well, that would have been good to know. So if you maybe are that person, outside eyes for sure. Let's actually just have somebody as an accountability character. And then two, if your face is too close to the book, it's hard to read the words on the page. And I don't know if I'm in that boat right now or not. You could be in that boat or not. I don't know. Maybe looking outside would make a lot of sense for both of us. Or maybe my form of intuitive training would be hampered by somebody's structure and I may end up injured or worse. I don't know. So the answer is never going to be clear, but there's a lot of ways to look at it.
Yeah, and it's really hard to tell if someone's lying or if they just don't know that they're lying.
Right, I agree.
The most common things we hear that are falsehoods are, I typically run blank miles per week. And you look at their Strava and you say, hey, is everything that you do on Strava? Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, no, you don't run 55 miles per week. You've ran 55 miles in a week. You average 32. which is fine, but that's what I need to hear. Or I have a really good handle on my training paces. Like I'm dialed in on my zones. I do fine. And then you start first week of running, you're like, is this typical? Like you said, is this typical for you? Mm-hmm. No, you don't have a handle on your zones. Or someone said, like, I'm really good with my anaerobic threshold. I know that very, very well. But what I need help on is I'm just not recovering well. And then you find out that, no, they had aerobic threshold and anaerobic threshold confused. Like, those are understandable things. They happen. So are you lying to me or do you really not know better? Yep. Either way, that's the person who needs a coach.
Yeah.
Even if it's just short term to get straightened out.
Yeah. Yeah. I find that more often.
Three times a week.
But do you?
No, you lift every single day. You just don't count it unless you touch like a barbell with set rest. But you did 4 Metcons last week, and then you did 1,000 pull-ups on the weekend. Like, you're not lifting 3 times a week. You're not.
Yeah. Oh, it's so interesting, isn't it? Human beings being human beings.
We're great at lying to ourselves to the point where we oftentimes forget that we knew we were lying.
That's why I'm sitting here with an Achilles that is potentially in real big trouble because I would lie to myself the last 2 weeks. Mm. If I had you and I said, hey, Brecken, Achilles is bugging me. What do you think? I don't know if I'd be sitting here today not able to run today or tomorrow because of it, right? And for that, it's invaluable potentially. The best.
I've been in the Vaporfly doing intervals yesterday or the day before.
You knocked that off, Brecken. Anyways, that outside influence is helpful. I think we do have to wrap this thing. Is that cool with you?
Very.
What are you up to this afternoon, Bracken?
Well, we only have one child at school today, so I need to go pick that child up. Mm. And then I'm hopeful that I have a package waiting on my porch, at which point I'm going to go do a medium long run on the trails.
Ooh, can you get back to me on it?
Oh, yeah. I'll probably call you breathlessly, panting, salivating from the trails.
I'm going to ignore you because I'm going to be with clients for the next 3 hours. So sorry about that.
I'm just going to keep calling. I'm going to text you. SOS emergency 911.
Uh-huh. All right. I think we're done. We didn't get to them all, but we did our darndest, guys.
That's all we can do. See you next time.
See you guys.
If anything resonated with you on today's episode and you're curious about taking your training to the next level, check out therunningpublic.com where we have a training plan to fit your needs.